Do you want to come up?
Great.
I just wanted to say that our speaker tonight is somebody that I've listened to for many years here in Santa Maria, somebody that I think works a fantastic program, and is somebody that I can really relate to. And so without any further ado, Leonard, please come on up here.
All right. Thank you, Derek. My name's Leonard, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leonard.
First of all, I want to say that I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never know what I'm going to talk about when I get up here, so it's kind of a process. I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not quite sure why I'm a little bit nervous. I think it's the tie. I think it's kind of restricting the blood to my brain. I want to thank Derek for asking me to speak. And this is kind of a monumentous event for me. being back in this room and the Golden Group is, first of all, I just turned 8 years on the first of this month, so I just celebrated the birthday. And my sobriety date is January the 1st, 2006. And so the last couple of years, about the last 18 months, have been really kind of rocky for me. And the reason why that has been is that for those of you that have been in the community for a while, you kind of know that there was a little bit of a transitional process going on with the Golden Group and Narcotics Anonymous and the Alano Club. And honestly, that really threw me for a loop, you know. And it really kind of damaged a lot of the relationships that I had in recovery. Those relationships, I really haven't been real keen about healing those relationships either. They haven't really begun to heal, and I've just been kind of doing this standoff, you know, this Mexican standoff, with my recovery and the fellowship. And part of that was because, you know, I cared so much about this, about the Golden Group, that I was really just kind of angry about the split and losing the Alano Club. And I have to be honest with you when I say that coming in here and standing at this podium and being in this room, there's a sense of healing that goes on here, because this feels really good and it feels like it's going to be okay, because it didn't feel like it was okay. It just didn't feel like it was okay, you know, and I still have some work to do with the other fellowship and the people in that fellowship, but you know, in time, you know. So let me tell you a little bit of like about what it was like for me. I grew up as, I'm a military brat. So I grew up as a military brat, the only boy of four sisters, and as a child, as a very young child, I was very sickly. I had asthma really bad. I can remember living in a tent for I don't know how long. All I know is I was in that tent, this little plastic tent, for so long that I literally had to teach myself how to walk once I got out of it. And so that gave me a real big sense of separation and being different. Always felt different. I've always felt separated. Quite like, you know, I didn't quite fit in, you know. I was having a conversation with my daughter last night, and she was telling me, she was going, "Dad, you know, I think I have a mental disorder. And, you know, that there's something wrong with me." And I'm like, you know, most teenagers think that there's something wrong with them, you know. And it took me back to that time when I was about her age, and I was really convinced that there must be something wrong with me. That there's no way that the rest of the people on this planet think the way I think or feel the way I feel. And I get it. I so get it. That I was just different. You know, a couple things for me growing up is that my father was a strict, not so much a strict disciplinarian as he was just a rageaholic. He was just an ass. He was a very scary man. He was just a very scary man. And so, you know, from as long as I can remember, I was terrified of my father. I was terrified of them. So I've always carried this sense of dis-ease just right in the core of my gut, you know? And it's kind of been the guiding force in my life, that there's been this little sense of dis-ease inside of me, especially in regards to authority figures and men and authority figures. Early on, I learned to deal with it by kind of going in the opposite direction of being just really just violent and just completely rebellious, You know, I kind of got in a lot of trouble as a kid, really at a young age. And, you know, and looking back, I couldn't quite figure it out. But, you know, I was a kid that would, I would steal stuff. You know, I would lie. I would just do just devious stuff. I mean, I'm talking at 8, 9 years old. I'm not quite sure why that was, but I just kind of had that thing inside of me. And I think looking back now, that was part of my way of kind of rebelling and getting back at my father, or trying to compensate for that fear that I had inside of me. What I do know is that even then and even now, I have a really hard time letting people get close to me. You know, I really have a hard time letting people get in. And so, and being an only boy in a house full of women, there's a couple of skills that I learned. The first one is I learned how to manipulate to get what I wanted. And the reason why I learned how to do that was because it wasn't okay to ask for what you wanted in my house. You know, I remember having this thought that, you know what, if I ask directly for what it is I want, I'm definitely not going to get it. You know, because I lived in one of those houses where, you know, it's like I was made to feel guilty. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, what do you mean? We don't have the money. And, you know, my dad was very just tight. So I learned how to manipulate to get what I want. I learned how to kind of give you what I wanted and move you around. And I kind of honed this skill very well. I also honed this skill very well in regards to women. See, so having all these sisters and my mother, it was like I lived in two worlds. You know, it was me and my dad and my sisters. And so I was kind of stuck in between these two worlds, and I never really fit into either one of them. But of course, being the only boy, there was a lot of advantages to that. You know, I kind of got this sense of entitlement. You know, and another thing that I had for me is that by the time I was born, my father, I'm second to the youngest. So by the time I was born, my father had advanced in the military to the point where he had some status in the community. So I had a little status in the community, and I had a certain amount of a certain novelty about me, being that in the military there wasn't a lot of African Americans. You know, the percentage was maybe 10%, but there also wasn't a lot of African Americans whose parents had status. So I had this novelty thing going for me. Now the reason why I share all that stuff is because I know as alcoholics we have our stuff. And when we get this stuff, we kind of bring this stuff up to you until that day, which I'm sure happened for most of them, but what happened to me, where I took that fixed pill or drink, for me it happened to be alcohol, and I put it in my system, and everything changed. Everything changed. All of a sudden, I didn't feel so different. All of a sudden, I didn't feel so alone. And all of a sudden, it was okay for me to let you in. Now, I have to tell you that I know that alcohol is not my problem. I have an ism. Like I told you before, when I was a little kid, I had the ism. I had it. And I can remember times prior to that where I had tried drugs and alcohol, and it really didn't do anything for me. But around about this time, when I was about 15, I must have been about 13, 12 or 13 years old, I specifically remember this incident, which was a turning point for me, was... I had gotten this girl's phone number, and I really wanted to call this girl, but I was scared. I was terrified. So I thought, you know what? I'll go get one of my mom's cigarettes, and I'll smoke this cigarette, and I'll have the courage to call this girl. And that sounds really kind of like just, you know, woo-woo, but whatever. But I smoked the cigarette. I called the girl. And then I can distinctly remember from that point forward, I knew that I could use something outside of me to change how I felt on the inside. From the very beginning, substances were a fix. I was trying to use something outside of me to make me feel better on the inside, right from the start. And I did. Sometimes I think I have Indian blood in me. I would not be surprised if there's some Native American in my blood somewhere. Because when you put alcohol in me, I turn into a complete fucking maniac. Excuse my language, I'm sorry. I turn into an absolute raving maniac from the very beginning. I remember one time my parents were having a party and they laid these little cups around. Now, those are Dixie cups. This was back when they had the little Dixie cups. And remember they had the half gallons and the decanters, and they had like the little, it was like a holder where you could tip it. And, you know, they had these cocktail parties. That's what they called them, cocktail parties. And, and you know, I was just a kid, and I remember running around taking the watered down cups and, you know, just sipping on them. Just, you know, I had really no intention of drinking. But what I do remember is waking up the next morning covered in vomit. So right from the beginning, I blacked out. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning. And it literally wreaked havoc in my life. Ironically, it wasn't alcohol that brought me to my knees, but it did wreak havoc in my life from the very beginning. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I was thinking about today, I was thinking about miracles. You know, I believe in angels and I believe in a higher power. I believe, you know, I believe that there's something else out there. And I know that there was a whole platoon of angels watching over me during my drinking career. Because I did some things and I went some places and I participated in certain activities that absolutely it took an entire platoon of angels to save me for myself. And that was just the alcohol. You know, there was a monumentous event that happened in my life that was really a big turning point. And, you know, you got to remember that up to this point, I lived in this sheltered little world. You know, I lived in this sheltered little military world where, you know, what I was this prima donna, I was a son. I was Little Flip, my dad was Big Flip, you know, and I had all these women that they resented me, but they absolutely adored me, you know, because I was their little brother. And my parents split up. We happened to be living in Germany at the time. And I have to tell you that I had a fantastic childhood. On the outside, I had a fantastic childhood. You know, we traveled all over the place. You know, I was in Germany at the beginning of puberty, which was in and of itself an adventure. But what happened is my parents split up. And my father came to California, and my mother moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And she didn't just move to Atlanta, Georgia. She moved to what they call the projects in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, if I don't know, if you're not from the East Coast, you know, out here we have barrios and hoods. There they have things called projects. And what projects are is they're government housing. The housing by the government, which is cheap housing, which is probably what you would consider to be inner city. So here's this sheltered black kid who's grown up in this predominantly white environment, all of a sudden finds himself in a absolutely black environment that's a low socioeconomic level. And it was a shock. It was just an absolute shock for me. And the way that I compensated is that I began to act out violently, and I began to use, I literally reverted to a criminal mentality, criminal mindset, a criminal view of life, and that became my reality. You know, that became my reality. You know, drug dealers, pimps, carjackers. You know, the whole nine yards. You know, and that's what I decided that I was going to do. I was going to become that. You know, and that became my that became my purpose in life. You know, and I became fully indoctrinated in that for a long time. You know, for a long time. You know, and what I know today is that because today I work with people that come from institutions and prisons, so I understand that mentality. You know, I understand that thinking. It's like living in two different worlds. The advantage was for me is that I had the opportunity to live in both worlds. I had the opportunity to live in both worlds, and again, that's one of those miracles that I talk about. It was a miracle that my father raised me the way that he raised me so that I could go to this place and still have this other perspective, you know. And, you know, and I remember telling my friends, you know, and I would come back and forth to California. I would fly to California and I would come out here and visit my dad and I'd go back to Atlanta. And I remember telling my friends, hey, man, you know, you don't have to live like this anymore. Okay, you know, there's a whole world out here, you know, and I knew that there was a world. And I remember them very distinctly looking at me and saying, you know what, Leonard, that world doesn't work for me. That's your world. It doesn't work for me. I can't function out there like you could. And at the time, I didn't understand it, but today I do, and I am so grateful for those angels that allowed me to do that. Otherwise, I would have never left the projects of Atlanta, Georgia, and I would have probably drunk myself to death or been killed by someone else or be in prison for the rest of my life. I know that without a doubt. But for whatever reason, I was allowed to escape. And I was allowed to escape to Lompoc, California. And so just kind of give you a little bit of a history lesson. You know, I When I came to Lompoc, it was during a time in the history of this country where, there was an epidemic of drugs. It's like I was at the forefront of the epidemic of the drug epidemic in Lompoc. And I came there with an open mind, which again saved me. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, and I'll share this now. I don't usually share this, but I was one of the original founders of the Crips in Lompoc. You know, I helped set that up, but I didn't set it up from the point of view of what they thought, because I had a different perspective of it. You see, which again saved my life. Had I bought into that mentality like they did, I would probably be in prison or dead to this day. But I didn't. I just saw it as a way of selling more drugs and me using more drugs. Because I found that I had to fuel this obsession that I had, which was with mood and mind altering chemicals. And remember, all along, I'm drinking. And I'm drinking and I'm doing stupid stuff and I'm getting in scrapes that are just phenomenal. I mean, phenomenal. You know, I remember one time it's just amazing to me that I survived. But I was so drunk that the Lompoc Police Department hogtied me. I mean, literally with my hands behind my back, my feet behind my back, and I was in such a state of rage that they even tried to sick a canine dog on me just to shut me up. I mean, it was just insane. And I survived through this stuff. You know, it was like, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. So that's where I came from. I came from that place. It didn't take long for me to find institutions. And along with those institutions, a little bit prior to that, when I came to live with my dad, you know, of course, he was convinced that there was absolutely something wrong with his son. So he sent me to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist sent me to AA. And I very distinctly remember walking into Alcoholics Anonymous in Lompoc and looking around the rooms and thinking, there's no way. There's absolutely no way. You know, and I walked out. You know, and then a couple of years later, the other fellowship began to grow, and I kind of got involved with that. You know, and what happened for me there was that my drinking and my other substances, I'm going to try to clean this up with that. My life began to become unmanageable. I began to start getting locked up and going into institutions. And I didn't like being locked up. So I figured out that I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could come to 12 Steps. And if I sat in that chair and I walked like you walk and I talked like you talked and I did the things that you did externally, a magic thing would happen. I would stop drinking. It's like I figured out that I came in here and I sat in this chair, my life, I would stop drinking. And if I stopped drinking, I wouldn't go to jail. And that's all I really wanted, was to not go to jail anymore. So what I ended up doing is I ended up using this fellowship. I've been using this program as a way of managing my alcoholism. Now, I share that because I know that there's lots of newcomers that come in here and do the exact same thing. And I did that for a long time. Matter of fact, I had it down to a science. Things would get bad. I'd run in here, and I would sit here long enough till I got a job, got some money in my pocket, got just everything, just, you know, enough stuff where I thought I could do it one more time, and I'd go back out there on another run. And I did this over and over and over and over and over and over again. On one of those occasions, they sent me to prison. They were like, all right, we've had it with you. We'll send you to prison. And so by this time, I had enough AA inside of me to know that there was a solution. You know, and one of the things that I know about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it has always given me and what I will always be grateful for is that it's always given me hope. It's always given me hope. I remember one flower festival where I got locked up. I mean, I never made it to a flower festival. And I'm sitting in this jail. I'm sitting in this cell in Lompoc cell jail. And I'm just distraught because I'm not getting out this time. I got a case or whatever. I just remember being like the darkest of the darkest. None of this is going to work. And in that room was a book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember thinking to myself, you know what? I don't think this is working for me. You know, and it was really just that one flicker of light in the very darkest. In the darkest moment, there just was that one flicker of light that just maybe this might work for me. I share that because I know, for me, that there's always that possibility that I will walk out these rooms and I will begin drinking again. And the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous will escape me. And if that ever happens to me, I will be doomed to the bitter ends. I know that that possibility exists. Because that day in that jail cell, I was that close. I was that close to saying, you know what? Nah. And so talk about angels. That same day, a boyhood friend of mine came in the next day. And he was put in the cell with me. And he was there for vehicular manslaughter. He had ran over our best friend. And I remember sitting there with him thinking, you know what? I feel so sorry for you. And the reason why I feel sorry for you is because I know that you don't have any hope. But I do. And it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried to talk to him about it. And of course, he wasn't there to hear that. He was thinking about, you know, oh my God, am I going to get life, blah, blah, blah. And I still don't know whatever happened to him. But I'll never forget that. And that was one of those miracles. That big book and that gentleman was a turning point for me. So they sent me to prison, my first prison term. And in that prison term, they sent me to Tehachapi State Prison. And at this time, Tehachapi State Prison was the only prison in California correction system that allowed AA meetings to come in from the outside. Only prison in the world. They had a group called the Roadsiders. Only prison in the whole state had just started. And I walked on that yard. And I'll never forget this. And I walked off that bus and I looked at the yard and it was all blue. What I mean by blue, there was all Southern Mexicans and all Crips. And I remember walking off that thing thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? And I saw a black guy walking across the yard and he had an Alcoholics Anonymous book in his hand. Another angel. And I ran over there and I said, hey man, what's going on? Blah, 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 blah. And come to find out, this was a gentleman who was a lifer, had come down in points, and he was part of this group. So Alcoholics Anonymous saved me, because if it had not been for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have had no other choice but to join the Crips gang and to Tehachapi, and I probably would have never left, because it was that active at the time. Another miracle. So while I'm in this group, it's called the Roadsiders. So I do my time, and I go home, and I have to share with you that, you know, even to this day, one of the guiding factors of my life today is that while I was in that prison, those men who presumably would never get out made me promise that I would not come back and that I would do everything I can to try to make sure that there was a difference made in the lives of those men inside that institution. And today I try to live up to that legacy. Those men saved my life. Absolutely. I wish I could tell you I didn't go back to prison, because I did, but but what happened, I'm going to hurry up because I'm going to get sober. But what happened is I got out of that prison and I went to a halfway house. Now, you can remember something. At this point, I'm fully indoctrinated in this Crip gangster kind of mentality. It doesn't matter that I've been in this institution. But, you know, I'm into lifting weights. I'm into knocking people out. I'm into all these things. But I'm trying to live this other way of life. So I go to this halfway house, and I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm going to give this thing a shot. And I go to this halfway house in Isla Vista, and I'm trying to go to these AA meetings, right? And I'm like, man, this is not going to work. And God sends me another angel. And there's this guy, man. He's like the most humblest. Just, I couldn't figure him out. He's humble. He's nice. He's sincere. He's loving. He's honest, and he really cares for me. And he's got this van. And he's running around in this freaking van, picking people up and taking them to meetings. And I'm going, who the fuck is this guy? What is he doing? But I was struck with the selflessness and the sense of service and the love that this man carried about him. It's like he just had this glow about him. And in this time, I was sitting on what I call the fourth step. What it really was, it was an autobiography. And that's what you do when you're in prison. You write. It was autobiography. I'd done my own fourth step. But I had to unload this fourth step. I had to get rid of it. So I asked this man to be my sponsor. And he took me through that fourth step. And we went to the beach and we burned it. And he told me a little story about the phoenix. And, you know, and we this relationship was solid. It was fused. The relationship was fused. And I think I hung around for a couple more months. And I kind of disappeared off the, you know, I went on to my journeys, so to speak. But the seed had been planted. My life, my feet, my existence was firmly rooted in Alcoholics Anonymous, regardless of how much I drank or used in between. It was rooted. I was in. And I went out and I did my thing some more, you know. And life, you know, and life got good, life got bad, life, you know, and I was in and out of the rooms, like I told you before, because I had reservations. And I'm gonna share this. I had this reservation, and here's the reservation. The reservation was that I could decide the lifestyle that I wanted to live. I was convinced that I could come in here in Alcoholics Anonymous and still live the lifestyle that I wanted to live. And that's a reservation. Because that step doesn't say we turn some of our will and some of our lives over to God. It says I turned my will and my life over to God. All of it, not 99%. And I used to tell all the time, you know, I was willing to give God everything except for my finances and my romances. And so I continued to relapse. And, you know, today I know that when I hold on to something tight, too tight, when it's time for me to let go of it, it's going to get ripped from me, even if I have to lose fingernails or a hand or an arm. If it has to go, it's going to go. And that's the way that I hung on to it. And I have to tell you that this last January of November, December of 2006, or 2005, I should say, it was ripped from me. It was ripped from me. You know, I hit a bottom that I hope everyone hits. I got enough pain that I hope everyone gets into. My life was turned upside down. And when it turned right side up, I was flat on my back, vertical, and in a state of surrender. Now, I don't want to go into details about what it was, but it was devastating. It was very traumatic. And it was life transforming. The only place that I knew where to turn was Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the only place I knew where to turn was Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and what happened is I walked from downtown Santa Barbara to East Beach, watched the sun come up, and I surrendered. And I asked my higher power, God, please help me. I'll do whatever you want me to do, but please help me. Now, they have that, you ever heard the saying, be careful what you pray for? Be careful what you pray for. I found myself within 6 months, I found myself in the L.A. riots, the worst riots in the history of the L.A. County Jail in the last 20 years. Then I found myself in prison. Then I lost everything, two homes, my father, and custody of my kids, all in this period of time. So to say that I was devastated is a understatement. And here's the irony of it, and here's the miracles. And then I found myself in prison with a year sober. I graduated. I mean, I celebrated 1 year sober in L.A. County Jail after having been in prison. And what happened is I walked out of that place. I walked out of that jail, and I walked out of L.A. County Jail. I jumped. I had to walk to the parole office, have them buy me a bus ticket. I wrote a bus ticket to Depot Street. They had a halfway house in Depot. And then from Depot, in the rain, I walked to the Alano Club, and I sat in a chair, and I stayed there. So that's that was the only safe place on this planet. Oh, and also I want to say I was sitting on another four step at the time as well. And I sat in that chair, and I was just distraught. I was devastated. But I was surrendered. I had surrendered. There's a part in the book where it talks about the first step in recovery, where we had to admit to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. That's an event. And once that event happens, nothing will ever be the same again. And I've had that event. And from that point forward, all I've had to do is be willing to grow along spiritual lines. And guess what? I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. Because I know that there's no place else for me to go except here. And there's no other principles that I need to apply except for the ones that you have taught me. I don't have to figure anything out. I just get to suit up and show up and do what those angels put in front of me to the best of my ability on a daily basis. And everything else seems to work out. And I don't know how. And trust me, I don't think it's going to work out. See, because I'm a planner. I'm a manipulator, you know. There's a saying in this program that there's nobody who's too stupid for this program, but there's a whole lot of people that are too smart. I am one of those people that is too smart for this program. I really need to stay a certain amount of dumb. You know, I really got to work on it. You know, I really do. Because I'm dangerous. I am lethal to myself. So I'm sitting on this fourth step, and I'm thinking, man, I need another freaking sponsor. And you have to remember something. I still don't open up to people well. I don't trust people. And for good reason. Had you come from the places that I've come from, you would not trust people either. That doesn't mean that it's not a character defect and it doesn't cause me harm. So I have a really hard time letting people in. And it's a trait that goes along with being institutionalized and coming from a criminal mentality. Because where I came from, no one, we would say we trusted each other, but, and I work with a lot of men that have this issue. And the thing is that if you have this issue or if we have this issue, that doesn't mean you can't recover. It just means you've got this issue. So I find it really hard to let men in or let anyone in or get too close. I love being alone. You know, I remember they would take me and they would throw me in an isolation shell and they would slam the doors and look at me and they'd laugh and I'd laugh back at them and say, you think you're locking me away? What you don't realize is I'm locking all of you out. And I was comfortable in that. And some days I still retreat to my hole and lock people out. But here's the thing. You guys taught me to work on the inside instead of the out. And what inevitably happens is when I lock you out, I get so uncomfortable. I get so miserable. I get so restless, irritable, and discontent that I have to come out of that hole. And usually what happens is if I stay in that hole month, I come out and I go run straight to the first fixed pillar dream. But you've taught me to run here. And thank God for that, because that's what has saved my life. So I'm sitting on the fourth step, and I'm looking for a sponsor, and now it's another impossible situation for me. You know, and God does for me what I can't do for myself. Because I've never met anybody who was as smart as I was. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had that problem. So it's kind of hard to find someone who you absolutely look up to because it's like, I mean, if you're as smart as I am, it's like, you know, there's no comparison. So God has to do for me what I have to do for myself. So one more time, I'm sitting in the meeting. And who walks through the door? That angel. And one more time, here he comes. And he's giving people rides, and he's still got that glow about him. He still has that peace about him. He still has that unconditional accepting love about him that only I can accept. There's no way I can get around it. You know. And I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. And thank God I asked him to be my sponsor. Because I'm going to tell you, that first year was just devastatingly difficult. I woke up every day wanting to go back to sleep and never waking up. I never thought it was going to get better. And every time I thought it was going to get better, something else happened. But every step of the way, right when I thought it wasn't going to get any better, God sent and put another angel in my life. And somebody or something happened to get me through to the next step. And my life began to get better. But more importantly, I begin to get better. I begin to trust just a little bit more. And I got to be honest with you, I still don't trust real well. But I trust enough to allow this process to happen. And that's really all the trust I need. You know, I did the fourth step. I went through the process. And then the miracles just started happening. I love that story about, you know, sobriety is like playing a country and western song backwards. You know, I love that. I love that because that's what happens. It just starts coming. You know, it just starts coming. You know, and I got to hurry up. I spent too much time getting drunk. Couple of things that I want to talk about that I want to touch on is, you know, if you're new, there's, you know, this process is really confusing. If you're old, this process is confusing. I still don't understand exactly why it works. But there's some things that I know for sure that has proven effective in my life. The first one is that if I find people that will support me, there's nothing I can't get through. I don't know where I got the idea that I was supposed to go figure shit out and then come show you how well I did it. It just has never worked for me. I've tried it. It just doesn't work. And of course, I play with it, play with it, play with it, and then finally I come and go, can you help me? And so one of the things that I've started to learn is that if I just allow someone to help me, my life gets better. Duh, what a concept. You know, and that's a really hard one that I have to work on. You know, and it comes from this part of me that feels so defective that I feel like I got to do something to make you like me. And then if I let you know that I'm not good enough, some hole's going to open up. And you guys are going to throw me in it, and I'm going to be ostracized for life. You know? And that feeling doesn't go away. You know, I thought that this stuff was supposed to go away. It doesn't go away. I just learned how to live my life with it. You know? And that was a hard one for me to figure out. Because when we get here, man, we are a freaking mess. If you're new and you're thinking everybody's okay, that's because they call it the pink clouds. You know what they say about clouds, right? Sooner or later, it's going to disperse. And that's why support is so important. The other thing that I know is that without honesty, I don't have anything. If I'm being dishonest, I'm going to drink. I'm going to drink because it's the foundation of my disease. If I just can be honest with just another human being, I got a chance. But as soon as I start practicing dishonesty, I am screwed, and I am screwed in a bad way. I didn't know that. Dishonesty is a reservation. I will drink again. The other one is resentments. I can't live with resentments. And I gotta be honest with you, I got some resentments going on, you know, and I'm thinking that they're okay, right? But I can smell them. I can feel them. They're there. I know. You see? But what I know about this program is that either I do the work or I get so miserable that I go. I was talking to somebody the other day. We were talking about, this is funny. We were talking about the Chinese zodiac. I don't know if you believe in that or whatever, you know. So they got this Chinese zodiac, right? So my Chinese zodiac sign is the ox, right? So I am one stubborn, hard-headed, obstinate individual. And that has probably caused me more problems than anything else in my life. But you know what? That day, when I was on my back, looking vertical, and I made that prayer on that beach, I surrendered. And I tell you what, no matter how obstinate I am, when it comes time to do what I need to do, I'm willing to do it. And I am so grateful for that. For a long time in my recovery, I was so resentful with my higher power because of all the pain that I had gone through to get here. I mean, some things happened to me that just should not happen to a person. And I was pissed off at God. Me and God were going to have a conversation when we met. But I have to tell you today that I am so grateful that my higher power allowed me to experience that kind of pain so that I would get to a place of that kind of surrender where I would be able to stay here with you people and live the life that I've been able to live. I cannot put a price tag on it. I cannot put a price tag on it. I am surrounded by people who absolutely love and adore me, even though I do everything in my power to push them away. I have a place to come where people love and accept me, even if I don't show up for months at a time. But most importantly, I have a way of life that works. And I never had anything that worked in my life. When it came to living life, it was a mess. It was just one mess after another mess after another mess. Today, I have a way of life that is just beyond my wildest dreams. I want to, again, what do you tend to? If you're new or fairly new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a way of life. It's a lifestyle. This is a program for living. It's got nothing to do with drinking. Drinking is 1% of the deal. The reason why it's the most important 1%, because if you drink, you're not going to get nothing else. Drinking will take you out of the game. But the other 99% is about learning how to live. And today I get to live. And if you're new, find somebody else in this program and do what they tell you to do. And do what they tell you to do. Because I could never figure this out on my own. But when I was able to come in here and do what other people asked me to do, all of a sudden my life started working. I mean, it's like if I could go out here and tell that to any person, out there and they would go, yeah, well, duh. But when it comes to alcoholics, it's an epiphany. It's like, wow, are you serious? And it never ceases to amaze. Oh, so, and I got to tell you, I work with men and women that are alcoholics and addicts that have been in prison, that have come out of prison. It's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this. Because they really don't want anybody telling them what to do, even though everything they've done has been landed in prison. So it's such an epiphany. But the thing about it is that when we do it, the camaraderie, the love, the fellowship, the healing that happens is just mind-boggling. It really is mind-boggling. You know, and I am extremely grateful. And I'll end with this. So I'm in Wasco State Prison one more time. And we're trying to get this little AA meeting started. And they don't have any outside meetings. So we decided we're going to have a meeting. It's three of us now. Now, this is prison. So we're in prison. And there's this white guy who's got like his eighth drunk driving. Now, you got to remember, this guy's like 65 years old, okay? He's in prison because he's got like his eighth drunk driving. All right? And he's hurting bad. And then there's this little Mexican kid who's like so strung out on meth that he can't even say his name straight. But he's beat up. So we get out of the AA book and we go in a little corner over here and we pull the book out and we start reading. And as soon as we start reading those words, that man started bawling. Now, of course, I was too tough to bawl, but inside, I'm bawling. Because when I heard those words, I knew that I had hope. And that's why every meeting, I identify as my name is Leonard and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there have been times where I have not been able to have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know how important and how life-saving they are. Thanks.
Wow, that was a fantastic talk. Let's give Leonard another round of applause.